Dr. Philip Stott is the engineer who built the Kwasi Sibantu Mission Auditorium, 10,000-seat auditorium. We were hearing just on Wednesday during our question on Islam, some of the incredible, extraordinary guidance of the Lord, how he was led to build that and led to Kwasi Sibantu for that, and how the Lord led him from being an atheist to a theistic evolutionist to being a creation science Christian. And that's a great testimony, well worth getting at other times. Well, the wonderful thing is when the Berlin Wall came down, the Iron Curtain collapsed, and the Soviet Union brought down the red flag, and Boris Yeltsin abolished the Soviet Union, the Russian Federation was born, and a whole of these idols were getting shipped off to the scrap heap. Philip Stott received invitations to go and to minister in Russia. So it's my joy to invite Philip Stott to come now and to speak to us concerning that ministry in Russia, which I know is a fascinating part of the work.
Was, as Peter said, working at Sibantu Mission, busy with mission support work, doing things not so glamorous like designing the sewage works and dealing with the roads in the airfield and building a school, building the auditorium. And while I was busy doing all this, I started helping out at the school because there was no person there who had any maths and science background. So I was asked to teach maths and science, and I was happy to do so. And along came an Australian and said, "I hear you're the science teacher." And I said, "Yes." And he gave me a cassette tape from Australia. And it was a man called Barry Setterfield. And he was giving the commentary to a slideshow. Now, my whole life, I had been very keenly interested in all branches of science. And as he was speaking, I could see the slides that he was talking about in my head. And I could see all of them because it was all stuff that I knew very well. But what he was saying about these things was really surprising. And I thought, well, this is very interesting. Maybe other people would like to hear this too. So I lent the tape to people, and everybody said, "Well, we've no idea what he's talking about," because they didn't have a picture of these things in their mind. So I sent to Australia and asked Barry Setterfield if he would send his slides to go with it. And so I would, I gave people the tape and the slides, and they would say, "But we don't know where to change the slide because, well, we really don't know what's going on." So then I would set up the projector, set the tape running, and press the button to change the slide when needed. And everybody said, "Well, that's fine, but his Australian accent, it's too difficult to understand. Won't you do it?" So I said, "Oh, wait a minute. If I'm going to say all this stuff, I'd have to be sure it was true. To me, it's an interesting point of view, but I don't know if it's true or not." And to find out if this stuff was all true, it would mean an enormous amount of time spent in the library. And I didn't have that time. I was busy with the auditorium. And then suddenly, the local authority descended on us. And they said, "What's all this building going on here? You've got no title to become a township. And this huge auditorium, what's that for? Is this, you're going to have rock concerts or something here?" And they closed us down. They said, "No more building here until we've looked into it all and decided what to do." So now I was left with no work to do on the auditorium and lots of time to go to the library. And Sibantu has cars going in every day and coming back every evening, so I had a lift to the university library. And day after day, I was there checking up on all these things that Barry Setterfield had been saying. And I found it was all true, and there was much, much more. So I decided I would give my own slideshows using the material that I'd found out in the library. So I just gave presentations for people at Caesar Bantu. And lots of visitors go to Caesar Bantu, and they started sending invitations for me to come to their congregations. Well, I'd never thought of doing anything like this, but, well, there were a lot of invitations, so I went. And I did quite a lot of slideshows all over South Africa. And it came to a point where I was invited to a sort of mission in Pretoria, where there was a man called Mark Kreitzer. He was an American. And he said, you know, this is a wonderful support for the Bible. But what are you doing about geocentricity? And I said, what? He said, about the earth being the center of creation. And I said, oh, is it? And he said, yes, haven't you read your Bible? And so I started looking, and I had read the Bible through from cover to cover maybe 20 times, and I'd never noticed that the Bible is solidly geocentric. And I thought, but this is crazy. Everybody knows that the earth is just a little ball lost in space, and even if there were a God, he wouldn't know where to look for it. That's what the atheists say. So I thought, how can the earth be the center? So I started looking into that. And surprise, surprise, I found all the evidence that science has says the earth is in the center of everything. And I started looking into this and put together a presentation. And as soon as this presentation was put together, I hadn't really told anybody, but once I had this presentation ready to give, suddenly I was absolutely flooded with invitations to go and speak everywhere. And a few weeks after I'd been giving a whole series of presentations, I got a phone call from Holland, from somebody I'd never heard of. And it was a man called Bert Doornbos, and he was inviting me to come and be their main speaker at a conference in Russia. And I said, but this is amazing. How do you know me? I've never been to Holland. How do you know me? And he said, oh, well, we've seen your videos. And I said, what? I haven't made any videos. He said, well, we've seen them anyway. So it turns out that when I had been going around the country giving presentations, people had been taking videos from the back when I didn't see them. And these had become fairly widely distributed. And, well, I thought, well, this isn't my mission. This isn't my field. I'm here as mission support at Caesar Bantu. Should I be going anywhere? But they said they really would appreciate it if I would go and be their main speaker. It was the first conference that had been organized in Russia since the Iron Curtain fell, and this conference was going to be on creation and evolution. And I thought, that's amazing, in Russia. such a solidly atheist country, we had visitors at Caesar Bantu who'd fled from Russia, and they told us how difficult it is to be a Christian in Russia. So I agreed to go, and I went to talk to Chell Olsen. He did a great deal of traveling, and I hadn't done any traveling for years. And I said, what about a visa for Russia? And he said, oh, the Iron Curtain's fallen now. It's become easy to get a visa. You can get one at the border. So I thought, fine, terrific. Off I went to the Netherlands, and the first thing Bert Doornbos said to me, I said, have you got a visa? I said, no, I was told I could get one at the border. He said, no, you can't. That's not possible. And the bus goes tomorrow, so first thing in the morning, we must be at the Russian consulate to see if we can get you a visa. So we were the first people there, and the bus that was leaving was a part of a scheme that Bert Doornbos was running. It was called the Children of Chernobyl Project. Now, there had been this massive nuclear disaster at Chernobyl, and it had produced radioactive pollution all over, and there were kids who were really suffering, and kids being born with terrible mutations. And Bert Doornbos had set up this scheme for fetching children from the affected areas to give them a 3-month break in a good environment. Now, his actual reason for doing that was to be able to put them in a Christian home. And but of course he didn't say that. And the Russian authorities were really impressed. They hadn't expected people in the West to be sympathetic and help them. And it really built up a tremendous rapport between this organization, Children of Chernobyl, and the whole Russian establishment. And so Bert was very well known to the Russian consul, and he went and said, look, we really need your help, because the Children of Chernobyl bus is leaving this morning, and after we drop the children, we're going to a conference, and this is our main speaker, but he hasn't got a visa. Can you organize something very quickly? And the consul said, well, since it's you, I'll pull out all the stops and get him a visa in the shortest time possible. That will be 7 days. So we said, but the bus is leaving in a few hours, and the conference will be over by the time I could get there if I left in 7 days. Sorry, there's nothing more I can do. So we left, and Bert and the others went off to join the bus. And a chap from Holland, he was an organizer, and a missionary from Germany, who was going to be at the conference as well, came with me, and they were going to try and help me get a visa from the ambassador. And the ambassador also was sort of very positive towards this group, because they were helping the Children of Chernobyl. And so they thought, we might stand a chance if we go to the ambassador. We got to the embassy, and the only person there was the secretary. And they had no idea when anybody senior would be back, didn't know when the ambassador would be back. So we went off to a coffee bar, and we got some hot chocolate. It was a cold day, it was winter. And we sat down, all very depressed. And Alex, the Dutch chap, said, Well, you know, there's actually no chance whatsoever of getting a visa. And we might as well give up. And Ron, the German, he said, well, yes, I might as well go back to Germany because I won't get the bus now. And it would take a miracle to get this to get a visa. It's just not possible. And then I piped up and said, but we serve a God who specializes in the impossible. He's very good at miracles. We failed. Let's pray and ask him. So we did. And half an hour later, I had a visa. But we had a problem because the bus had left. But Alex knew of a Dutchman. He was called Maasbach. And he was a businessman, but he used to go to St. Petersburg every weekend to do evangelization. And he had just got a new car, and he decided he wouldn't trade his old car in. He would send it up to St. Petersburg so that he would have transport when he got there, because transport was always a problem. And he hadn't the time, he couldn't afford the time away from his business to drive this thing up to Russia. So he wanted somebody to drive it to St. Petersburg. And there we were, wanting to go to St. Petersburg. So off we went. And when we got there, we found a really amazing situation. At the center where we were going to hold this conference, there was the final year English student contingent with the head of department, and the head of department announced that as part of their training to give them experience in speaking English, she was assigning one of the students to every one of the foreign delegates as a personal translator for the duration of the conference. And every one of the people on the European delegation, or, well, it wasn't just European, there were Americans as well. We were all Christians. And each one of us had a captive Russian audience of one, a captive Russian mission field of one, and we all got together and decided by the time we leave, we can give our Bibles to a new convert. We all agreed that we can do that in a week. And I was very fortunate. I got the top student. And this student was a really brilliant student. Very, very conscientious. A very good interpreter. And this conference was a real eye-opener to us. All the Russians, of course, were supporting evolution. And they were all really high-ranking scientists. And Russian scientists have to be able to speak English very well. They have to be able to translate an English technical paper as part of their exam. They've got to be able to stand there and sight unseen translate a technical paper. That's a pretty high standard of English. But the official interpreter for the conference was the head of the English department at the university. Now, she could speak English very well, but she had very little scientific and technical knowledge. So this meant when I gave my presentations, there were many citations from top scientists, scientists everybody knows, showing that they appreciated that actually the standard stories about evolution and millions of years and such things were not tenable, they weren't true. And scientists always tend to use technical jargon, and on each of these slides supporting my demolition of evolution, the English professor struggled a little and gave a translation, but it was, you know, some of the technical words were misplaced. And so these Russian scientists, they said, no, this ought to be translated this way. And then the next one would say, even better would be to translate it this way. So every single slide, it didn't just flash past, everybody concentrated on it, put in all their effort to get the real meaning out of it. And by the time they had finished their translation, even the people in the audience who weren't technical, they now fully understood all this. This was the most amazing, thing. And I found that everybody was tremendously attentive. I gave the first lecture, and everyone was very attentive, and they were sort of sitting on the edge of their seat. And then, after I'd finished, one of the Russian scientists gave a presentation, and I could see why, because this presentation was in a style which Russian scientists had developed out of fear. They had come to realize they had to be able to give a lecture without saying anything, because if they said anything, the KGB might have them up and they'd be in trouble, because what they'd said wasn't acceptable to the authorities. So these lectures were all absolutely boring. And the interpreter was interpreting, but you know, it was sort of lots of technical jargon meaning nothing. And I asked my interpreter, do you understand this? She said, oh no, but aren't they clever? So it was an absolute bore every time the Russians were there speaking about evolution. And everybody was ever pleased when I was there giving lectures that they could all understand. So it went astoundingly well. And at the end of this conference, the Russian state television people came, and they had interviews with the people who'd been there. Now, it was all in Russian, so they only dealt with the Russian people who'd been there. And my interpreter, being the star pupil, she was one of those that was asked to go and to give an assessment of the conference. And she said, this has been an amazing conference. We've learned lots of things. We've heard the truth here for a change. And we've learned that most of what we were taught in school is not true, that evolution is utter nonsense, the Earth's only a few thousand years old, and the Bible is the only reference source we can trust. This was absolutely amazing, and this on Russian state television. Well, the conference was over, and I got flooded with invitations from the scientists to come and speak at their universities. Now, also at this thing, there had been very senior people from the Russian Orthodox Church. As far as I could make out, the main seminary for training Russian Orthodox priests was there in St. Petersburg. And the leader there invited me. He said, won't you come and give lectures at our seminary? So I was flooded with invitations, and I had to arrange to come back. And my interpreter said, when you come back, can I interpret for you? And she was a very good interpreter, and by this time she was a thoroughly converted Christian. And I thought, well, this would have a big advantage because I can send her all my citations long before. She can translate them and she can get them checked with scientists, because this I found was the big problem. The citations that I use in my presentations are almost always from scientists. They're not easy and they're very important in putting forward my arguments. So this seemed like an amazingly good way to go. So I arranged to come back and go to lots of universities, and I sent her all the citations that I would be using for her to get them all ready. And then I went back. And as well as going to all these places I'd been invited, I thought, what I ought to do before I go and give these lectures, I ought to go and sound out the Russian psyche. I need to see what these people, what's going on in their mind. Because I had seen at this conference, the whole outlook was very different to Europe. And so because I was involved with the children of Chernobyl, I managed to organize invitations to go and see a lot of very senior people in a lot of very senior positions. So before I went for my lecture tour, I went to see them and I asked them a lot of things. One of the things I asked the first time round, the first one of these people I got to, I said, tell me, what do you see as the most necessary thing for Russia now? What does Russia really need? And this fellow astounded me. And he said, the only hope for Russia is if the people will live according to the Bible. And I was astounded. And I said, do you believe the Bible? He said, oh no, science has proved the Bible's wrong. But the only hope for Russia is if people would live as if it were true. And this astounded me. So the next time, the next one I went to, I asked the same question. I got exactly the same answer. And again I asked, do you believe the Bible? Oh no, science has proved it's not true. But the only hope for Russia is if people will live as if it were true. And this happened time and time again. And I thought, there is really some hope here. If I can show the people they can believe it, because it's not been disproved by science, there is real hope that the response, it may make a difference. And so I started my first tour, going from university to university, and the amount of interest was amazing. The lecture halls were all full, and the people who wouldn't miss it, they were the professors, the lecturers, the staff. Now, in European universities, American universities, Canadian universities, I have found that you get a lot of students who come, but very few of the lecturing staff. But here, they were the first ones there. And they had the attitude, we've been lied to about politics. we've been lied to about economics. We've been lied to about so many things. Will we be able to learn the truth about science here? And everywhere they were very, very receptive to what I was saying. I went to one or two of the universities, and the authorities came beforehand and said, look, we hear you're giving lectures. It must be clear and understood, this is a secular university. You're not allowed to do things like mentioning the Bible. Okay, fine. So the staff were all there and everybody around was there. And so I gave my lecture. I didn't mention the Bible at all. I finished the lecture and one of these senior professors stood up and he said, but this means that the Bible's true after all. Well, I think really, you know, I haven't got time to tell you about all the astounding things that the Lord allowed me to be part of there. But on one of my trips, I had been reading the book Aida of Leningrad. It was about one of the Russian Christians who had stood for the faith and been terribly mistreated, but it didn't stop her evangelizing again every time she was let out of jail. And each time she was put back in jail, she was jailed for longer and mistreated more harshly. And this book was Aida of Leningrad, and the name of this woman was Aida Skripnikova. Now, by this time, I had been there often enough to realize that the churches that are there were useless for directing converts to. So, people who, after my presentations, they really wanted to know more. They wanted to get into this Bible that seemed to have all the answers. And I looked at the churches, and there were, shall we say, Dutch Reformed, Russian Orthodox churches, which is all formality. The service is chanted in ancient Slavonic, nobody understands it anyway. They just bow to idols and burn candles to the saints. It's useless sending them there. And then the churches which had been collaborating with the state to survive, I found that as soon as I got there, I could see these are not really, these are not like the Christians that go to Sisavantu. These are lukewarm people like in the West. And I thought, well, Aida Skripnikova was a member of this underground church. What I need to do is to find her and find out which church I can direct converts to. But I thought, how on earth will I find this woman in the whole of St. Petersburg? It's a very large city. And there's no telephone directory. Everything in Russia was very third world. The people were all first world. My son came with me on one trip and he said, this is amazing. It's first world people in a third world country. And things like telephone directories. No, everybody gives their telephone to their friend and that's it. So how could I find Aida Skripnikova in this city? Well, I came in contact with an Anglican priest. There was an Anglican church in St. Petersburg, because there were quite a lot of English people working in Russia, and not just in the consulate, but in there were businesses also, just a few, but enough to make it worthwhile having an Anglican church. And I was talking to this chap, and he looked at his watch and he turned to his wife and he said, "Oh, I have to go to Aida." And I said, "Not Aida Skripnikova." He said, "Yes, do you know her?" I said, "No, but I want to. Can I come with you?" So I went and I met this marvelous woman. Now, she has been quite disabled by all the beatings she got, but so full of joy and radiant, a radiant Christian. And so she agreed me to take me to her church. It was sort of like a barn with trestles and empty oil cans with planks across for people to sit on. And there were Christians just like the ones that we'd met at Caesar Bantu. And I was so thankful. Now I had somewhere to tell converts to come to. But to come in contact with Aida Skripnikova in that great place with no telephone directory, it was just so amazing. It was like getting the visa. Only the Lord could do that. Now, I got invitations not only to universities, but to municipalities. And it was an amazing situation where the mayor of a city would order all his civil servant underlings to come to a lecture. And I thought, this is amazing. These are all communists, and they're giving me such a good opportunity to bring the gospel. And in Europe, they're not interested. There was one sort of problem that I had. When I was at a place and there were people who really wanted to be counseled, there was only my interpreter, because my Russian wasn't good enough to lead somebody to the Lord, but hers was brilliant. And there was opportunity for much more than that. And at one of the presentations I gave, there was a person from a university in a place I'd never heard of. It was called Cheripovets. Now, it's a very large city, about 2 or 3 million people, and nobody's ever heard of it. And you haven't heard of it because it's a secret arms manufacturing city. That's all that they do there. They just manufacture arms. And he invited me to come to the university in his city. And so I said, fine, yes. And so I got on the train and went with him, and checked into a hotel. Half an hour later, the KGB were there. And they wanted to put us under arrest. But this fellow said, "Oh, but they're going to give a lecture at my university in an hour's time. Can't you pick them up after?" So they arrested my son and took him off to Chucky. And they sent someone to watch over me that I didn't escape while I went to give the lecture. So I gave a lecture at this university. And as soon as the lecture was over, scientists from other departments came and said, "Will you come and give a lecture in my department?" So got out of the room to go to theirs, and there were the KGB to pick me up. And the scientist said, "Oh, but look, please, he's going to give a lecture in my department. Can't you take him after that?" So they said, "All right." And this went on all afternoon. And meanwhile, back in the police station, they were interrogating my son, Robert. And soon became clear to him that what they really wanted was to get some money out of us. And they were saying, "What? It's illegal, you're being here. You need to pay a fine." And I think they said something like $50. Now, in Russia at that time, $50 was worth half a million rubles. So my son said, "Well, you know, this is Russia. You can't put fines in dollars, surely the fine is in rubles." And they said, "Oh, well, yes, in rubles it's 10,000 rubles, but we'll accept $50. Now, 10,000 rubles at that time was about, what, one rand. Say, 30 American cents. Because the currency had fallen so drastically that the fines in the books hadn't kept up, so it was still at a level that was appropriate for a long time before. So my son said, "Well, look, we are quite happy to pay 10,000 rubles, and that's surely the law." And they said, "Well, we can put you in jail." And he said, "Well, it would be a privilege to be in jail for the gospel." And that really shook them. They thought, "Well, it's not any good threatening them with jail either." So they accepted the 10,000 rubles. And by the time I finished the last lecture, it was all sorted out. Now, the chap who had invited me, he was studying at this university. But underground, he was a pastor. And when this was over, he said, "Would you come and give lectures in my church?" So I did. And it was an on-fire church. It was full of people who were really on fire for the gospel. And they said, "Can we come with you when you go to universities? Because when people have heard your message, they're going to be open. And if we are there, we can take over when you finish." So they started coming with me to the universities. And it was really rather amazing, because the lectures would finish and then the room wouldn't empty. There would be this huddle where all were Arkady and his congregation were evangelizing the people who'd been stunned by the presentations. And then at one stage, they decided to hire a cinema and invite everybody to come to the cinema. And I gave a presentation. And when I'd finished, Arkady stood up and he said, "I'm sure there are many people here who have been challenged by what they've heard and would maybe like to hear a bit more about the Bible and what you can learn from it. And if anybody would like to come and be counseled, then we're all here." Not one person left the cinema without being counseled. I think one of the real highlights of my trip in Russia was a university in a very old Russian town called Vologda. It has the name Kotlia for Russia, which means the melting pot of Russia. It has the reputation for being the place where new ideas were developed and from there they spread. And at the university there, the director was a scientist who had been a scientific advisor in Zambia. And in Zambia, he'd spent 3 or 4 years speaking English. And Russian scientists learn pretty good English anyway, and so he was very competent in English, and he liked showing it off. So he enjoyed chatting to me. He didn't really know what my presentations were about. He never saw one, but he organized that every department in the university would host a presentation, and he sent one of his minions to organize with all the heads of department when their turn for a lecture would be. And that went fine until it came to the English department. And then the English department said, "We don't want a lecture. We want an opportunity for our students to speak English. So we would like a discussion group for you to lead, and we'd like to have it on South African politics." And I thought, oh my, I don't think the Lord sent me here to give a seminar on South African politics, but well, Lord, you're in control. Whatever you send my way, I'm happy with. And so I organized this this set of meetings. Every department lined up. The last one was physics, and the English department was somewhere in the middle. And so I'd just finished a lecture at the history department, and I had a slideshow on the disastrous influence of evolution throughout history. And so I got to the English department feeling, oh well, now comes my waste of time. And this was one place where my interpreter wouldn't be needed because everything was in English. And we arrived, went in, and the head of department called the students together and said, "Right now, students, into your groups for the discussions." And at that moment, the director of the university walked in. He hadn't been to any of the other lectures. He didn't come to any of the other ones. I presume he came to show off his English. But he came in and he talked to the department and he said, "Well, English class, You are fortunate today in being able to listen to one of Professor Stott's famous lectures. I'll leave you to it. So everybody was stunned, but I had my projector on the stand before anybody could say a word, and I was into one of my lectures. And everybody looked very glum, and at the end of it I said, well, are there any questions? And there was absolute silence. And the head of department came to me, very shaken, and said, well, thank you for your lecture. And I said, but it looks as if nobody's understood it. She said, oh yes, we all understood it, but you see, we are all atheists, and you've just destroyed the foundation of our beliefs. And then the other really memorable one from that university was the last lecture. It was in the physics department, and I went and gave them a lecture on the cosmology of the Bible. And it was the only meeting that I noticed there were no staff members there. It was only students. There were the research students and the undergrads, and I gave my presentation and threw it open to questions. And one of the research students stood up at the back, and he was furious. And he looked like an Old Testament prophet prophesying doom against Israel. And he said, none of our lecturers were here today. They didn't come because they know they're telling us lies. But these walls have heard the truth, and they repeat it back to generations of students in the future. Wow. Well, it wasn't all that long after that until I was in another Russian town, which I'd never heard of. It was called Novocherkassk. And that was down in the south, right next to Chechnya. Now, I didn't know this was a problem, and I didn't know that this city had two functions. It was full of universities, and it was full of military bases. And I was invited to the universities, and I gave lectures at one or two, and I was on my way to the next one. And when I arrived, the head of the university was there. He said, you have been followed by the KGB. We think they're going to arrest you. Just be very careful. So I gave this lecture, and at the end of it, the director said, they're wanting you to go to my office. So I went there, and we're taking you to the Avia office. That's the KGB office. And we got there and said, you're here illegally. I said, well, why do you say that? To say, you've no visa for Novocherkassk in your passport. And I said, but at the embassy, they told me if I've got St. Petersburg and Moscow in my passport, then I can go anywhere in the country. Rubbish! This is the law. He opens the book. Look at it. This has been like this for years, never been changed. Now, that's the situation there in Russia. The laws are all still as they always were. It's not that they've been changed, it's just that they choose to overlook them when it suits them. And so I was there illegally, in spite of what the consulate had said, and they said, we're giving you 24 hours to get out of the country. And they wrote what they called a protocol against me, which they said they were sending to every consulate and every border crossing point with orders that I was not to be allowed back into the country. So I was thrown out, but not so very long afterwards, I got a message from Arkady, and he said he had moved his whole mission to Kolomna. He said Kolomna has become so open to the gospel that his team have moved there because they've got a mission field wide open. Well, I haven't tried to get back. Maybe by now their protocol might have expired, but I'm now too old anyway. My memory is not what it used to be. And in order to do what I was doing, I had to keep up with what the leading edge of all the fields I was dealing with, because a geologist could confront me on anything. An astronomer could confront me on anything. A biologist could confront me on anything. I had to keep abreast of all that was going on so that I could answer any of these people if they came against me. Because I have discovered long ago that the presentation is all right, but everybody sits there thinking, well, can I believe what he says? But afterwards, if someone stands up and challenges and you can answer, then everybody thinks, aha, he really does know what he's talking about. But to do that, you've got to be able to answer. And so this took a huge amount of my time. I had a very good memory. It's not too bad now, but it's not a young person's memory, so that mission field is now really not open to me. But while it lasted, I'm really thankful that the Lord gave me the opportunity to see wherever I went, his hand working and showing by the way he allowed things to happen, that he was with me. And what a privilege that is. Well, does anybody have any questions?
How long ago was that?
Well, I think I was thrown out in 97 or 98. So I was there for about 5 or 6 years. I was in Russia for about half of the year. I would go twice a year. I'd go for something like 2 or 3 months. And and then I would go back home and do what I was doing at Caesar Bantu. But it was long enough to get to love those people. It was long enough to become pretty proficient in the language. In fact, by the time I left, I would handle questions and answers on my own. I wouldn't need an interpreter to understand the questions and give the answers back. I could travel around on the buses, on the trains, go shopping, and get by very, very well. But now, not going there, I've lost it all.
I
don't. I got a message from an evangelist who works in Russia about 4 years ago. He would like to meet me. He was speaking at a church in Bloemfontein. And I thought, well, I wonder why he wants to speak to me. So I went, and he said, well, there are a lot of people in Russia who asked me to give you their greetings. So maybe not quite forgotten yet. Yes.
So a little off the topic. So how old is the Earth?
How old is?
The Earth.
The Earth? Well, I think if God wanted us to know the exact age, he would have told us. But it's quite clear from the Bible that it is not more than about 7,000 or 8,000 years. And when you look at the scientific evidence, about the maximum age you can get for an Earth which will support life would be 10,000 years. But that's a maximum. Now, of course, the establishment doesn't like to admit that. People are not allowed to say that the timescale is short. I was at a seminar in Midrand, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And at the special conference dinner, I happened to sit next to a geologist from WITS. And I said, oh, I'm so glad I've got the chance to speak to you. I was wondering if you could tell me what the geological fraternity think about the dinosaurs that Mary Schweitzer has been finding, which are unfossilized. They've still got flexible blood vessels. They've still got blood cells in them. I'd be interested to hear what the geological fraternity thinks of that. And he said, well, it's obvious it means the timescale is very much shorter than we thought. I said, well, yes, it does, but are you telling your students that? And then he started to duck and dive and dodge and say, oh, well, you know, the actual timescale's not really important. What matters is the sequence of the rocks. Yes, but do you tell the students that the timescale is much shorter than... Well, we mentioned the timescale in the first year, but from the first year on, we only deal with the sequence of the rocks. Yes, but when you talk about the timescale, do you tell them that it's only much shorter than you have been thinking? And he said, well, no, we don't tell them that. They still carry on with their lies. They know perfectly well. But the universities have known this for a long time. About maybe 8 or 9 years ago, the maths department at Bloemfontein University, or University of the Free State, invited me to give a series of lectures, and they organized a lecture room and advertised it, and I went along and I gave the first lecture, and then I was banned from the campus. What had happened was that the professor from biology and the professor from geology had gone to the university authorities and said, this fellow is a troublemaker. He is sowing doubt among our students about what we are teaching, and we insist that he is banned from giving any more lectures. And they said, all right, so the next week, we couldn't hold the lectures there. We organized an alternative, but everybody had been told it would be there in that same room. So we went along to put a notice on the door saying where the new room would be, and there was the professor of geology saying, "What are you doing here?" And so I said, "Well, we've come to direct people to the new venue. Wouldn't you like to come?" He said, "No, I don't want to come and listen to your lies." I said, "Look, I would be so pleased if you would come, and every time I told something that was not true, you would point it out and tell us the truth. Wouldn't you like to come along and do that? We'd be so grateful." This professor said, "No, I'm going drinking." So the people in the maths department were really upset, and they said, "But surely if someone is saying something that what you're teaching is not true, surely you should be able to defend it and show that it is true. If somebody were to come along to the maths department and say we are teaching things that are not true, we'd examine it and see if it is, and if it is not true, we'd stop teaching it. Now, why don't we organize a public debate where you have an expert from the geology department, an expert from the biology department, and you can debate against this fellow and show him where what he's saying is wrong?" No. Nobody in the geology department would debate against me. Nobody in the biology department would debate against me, because they know perfectly well they haven't got a leg to stand on. They know that evolution, they know that the time scale is just not defensible. But as long as there's nobody to challenge them, they can carry on regurgitating, taking the nonsense, and the students have just got to learn it. Now, there was a Darwin centenary, or I think it was 150 years of Darwin, and there was a series of lectures organized, and I phoned and said, "These lectures sound interesting. Will there be question and answer afterwards?" No questions and answers after any of the lectures. So I didn't bother to go. This is the way they have gone. They know perfectly well what they're saying is not true, but they dare not have it exposed by even allowing questions and answers at the end of their lectures. Well, as far as geology goes, I would immediately go for the dinosaurs, because it's pretty well known, it is irrefutable, and it is something that catches the imagination. Everybody loves dinosaurs. And to find remains of Tyrannosaurus rex that are clearly only a few thousand years old at maximum is stunning for anyone, especially children. So that would be a really good one. Genetic decay, that's another good one. There is a project called the ENCODE project. It's actually been going on for quite a while, but the results came out maybe, the first results came out more or less about 3 years ago, and they astounded everybody. Now, the people who did these experiments were scared stiff, because they know that if anybody comes out and says they don't believe in evolution, they will be thrown out of the job, they'll have their qualifications cancelled by the university, they will be blacklisted, they'll never get anything published. So people are absolutely dead scared of being thought to be anti-evolution. Now, the ENCODE project, it was looking at, in detail at the way the genetic information in the double helix spiral is actually used by the ribosome. And what happens is bits of the whole sequence are copied from various places and they are spliced together to make one section of code to send to the ribosome for it to work on and produce what it's supposed to produce. Now, the problem with this is the genome project had worked on the assumption, which all the scientists had proudly made, is that the parts of the genetic code that they thought they understood, they were real code. And all the parts that they didn't have a clue what it could possibly mean, they had called junk. Well, if they couldn't understand it, it must be junk. And that means there's about 3% of the genome of most creatures, including men and apes, and there's about 3% which they considered this is actually information, these are genes, the rest is junk. That's part of evolution, you know, it used it in the past, and now it's gone out, it's not useful anymore. And so there was this story about junk DNA and the real DNA, which was about 3%, and the 3% they thought they could understand. And then they came to see what was being put in the information that was sent to the ribosome for processing. And there was much more junk than what they thought was the real information. Now, they've come to realize that that so-called junk is actually meta-information. It is there to show the ribosome how to use the information in the parts that they had recognized as information. It's like the computer program which tells you how to control the data. And now this completely wipes out all their evolutionary stories. You know, the genetic system is so complex that to try and pretend it happened by chance, you know, it stretches the imagination, and they'd had to go to a lot of lengths to make out that this was possible. But now when all this junk is actually much more complex stuff than the stuff they'd recognized as data. And not only that, but each time it's going to be used, what the system requires picks out the particular parts that put together will give the result they want to make. There's intelligence in this. This is astounding. This is such evidence for a fantastically intelligent creator that they thought, oh, look, when we put this forward, it's just so obvious that evolution cannot explain it. We are going to be chucked out as non-evolutionists. So the first paper they put out on this, it's the first paper I've seen anything like it. All the papers that they do usually is they give the data that they've got. And the data, the information, always supports what the Bible says. But the rest of it is explaining how this fits in with the theory of evolution. So it supports evolution after all. So the first part of the paper is the data, the rest is the explanation, all of which squeezes it into the evolutionary framework. But now they realized it was not possible to do this. So this paper starts off with every member of the genuine product of the project is a firm believer in evolution. So how come they need to bring this up at the start? And we are confident of that our data supports the theory of evolution. And they go about this whole introduction showing what good evolutionists they are. Then there's the data that shows that evolution is just not tenable. All the stories about the genetic code which the evolutionists had been given are proved to be junk, rubbish, they're out the window.
Carbon dating doesn't even work because they found on a dinosaur, the one bone was so many million years and the other one was a couple of million less and the other from the same bone.
No, well, carbon dating was introduced by Professor Willard Libby about, what, something like 40 years ago. And in his introduction, that book is called Radiocarbon Dating. And the first maybe 10 pages are an introduction. And by page 7, he has given all the information you need to see that this method is totally invalid. And he's put the information there. I can't see how he didn't understand that himself, but the information he puts there completely invalidates the method, because the method assumes that the level of radiocarbon in the atmosphere has been constant for at least the length of time that you want to try and date. Because you assume that all the way back in the time that you're dating, animals, plants were taking in the same amount of radiocarbon. So it must have been at a constant level as far back as anything you're going to try and date. But on page 7, he points out that the level of carbon dioxide, of radiocarbon in the atmosphere is 20% lower than the equilibrium value. Now, if you plot the curve rising up to equilibrium, it's an exponential. It fades away asymptotically, so the last little bit takes a long time. So if you bring it back to 20% below equilibrium, you're at an age of 10,000 years. Now, if you go back 10,000 years, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is zero. If this is the curve that they believe it is, if this radioactive material believes the way they believe it acts, 10,000 years, there was no radiocarbon, which means that you cannot date anything back at all. You can only date once you've reached the equilibrium. It's going to take another 30,000 years to reach equilibrium. So what can you do with what's here? Well, what you can do is calibrate. What you can do is you can say, well, we look back at something which we know is 4,000 years, see what the radiocarbon levels are then, and say, then if we find something with that level of radiocarbon, we know it's 4,000 years old. If we can find something 5,000 years old, we can do the same. And so going back in history, we can plot what the curve would say. Now, it's not what you calculate, assuming that's equilibrium. We know it's not equilibrium. So Libby, in his paper introducing this to the scientific community, it's really amazing what he admitted. He said, when we wanted to check this out, our intent was to do it in two stages. First of all, we wanted to date historic material and then prehistoric material. And he said, we got our first shock when we discovered that history goes back less than 5,000 years. We found that the ancient dates you hear about, this civilization 15,000, 20,000 years ago, they are all speculation based on almost no evidence. But the only things that we could date with any certainty only go back to Egypt. Now, that isn't even 5,000 years. It's less than 4,000. So the maximum age they could even calibrate, 4,000 years. When they started doing this, they discovered that that doesn't work either, because you take one piece of wood from that same excavation and another piece of wood, and they give different dates. And then they discovered that different plants have different abilities to keep out radiocarbon. Now, radiocarbon is radioactive. It does damage. Plants try and keep it out. And if they're growing very slowly, all their pores can close up to the point where they can discriminate and keep the radiocarbon out. If they're growing quickly, everything is more open because things are happening faster, and so it lets more in. So with any plant, how much radiocarbon it's taking in depends on the speed at which it's growing. And between different plants, it depends on how effective they are in excluding radiocarbon. So if you want to do radiocarbon dating, you've got to take a particular kind of wood in a particular kind of area and see, well, the dates we get there are always in the region 1,500 to 1,700. So if we date a piece of wood from that region, we can be pretty confident we got the right date. But if it's from somewhere else, where the growing conditions are different, or if it's from a different wood, well, we haven't got the factors, you know, we haven't got enough data to get the correction factors. So radiocarbon labs give two dates. One is what they call a corrected date, and the other is the raw radiocarbon date. The raw radiocarbon date has got no previous data of that kind of material to check with, so they just give you what the sums say. We had a wonderful example of how accurate that is. A few years ago, there was a woman in Durban, her name was Mrs. Fourie, and she was a keen artist. She went to some rock painting courses in Pretoria, and as part of the course, they painted some rock paintings, traditional looking rock paintings on rock, and she took them home with her to her home near the golf course in Pietermaritzburg, and they were stolen. Now, somebody found some amazing San rock paintings in Pietermaritzburg and took them to somebody at the university, and he was absolutely overjoyed. He didn't know there were any Bushman paintings in the area. He sent them off to the radiocarbon laboratory at Cambridge University. It's one of the most famous in the world, and said, would you please date these rock paintings? These rock paintings are 1,200 years old. This is a record for South Africa, and got in the newspapers, and the lady who had painted them saw the pictures and said, ah, they were stolen from my garage 3 years ago. Now, that is how reliable radiocarbon dates are. Yes.
I believe that they did the same thing with the St. Helens volcano in America.
Yes, they took samples from the new cone that was being formed, sent it to data. This wasn't radiocarbon. This was uranium lead and strontium rubidium, and those laboratories said millions of years. They had just formed.
So the other dating methods that they fall back, the strontium and carbon, you know, all the other kind of, are they any good or do they suffer the same problem?
Well, look, there have been tests done. People long ago realized that there's something very wrong with these dates. And they decided the only way you can see how useful they are is to calibrate them against rocks of known age. And the only rocks of known age are very recent ones. You can only radioactively date volcanic rock. You can't use radiometric dating to date any sedimentary rocks. You can only do it for volcanic rock, and the only known dates for volcanic rocks are those which were poured out within historic times, and they're on the whole something like 100 years old for the oldest recorded outpourings. And one such outpouring was on it was the volcano Hualalai on Hawaii. And so the various radiometric dating methods were tried out there because they knew this is 100 years old, so our dating techniques should give us effectively zero. And they found that potassium argon gave ages which ranged from 60 million to 160 million years. Uranium lead gave 4,000 million years. So you can see how useful these dates are. And if you send a sample to a laboratory, they will want to know where it is from, because they will want to be able to check on their geological map what rock could be there, so how old it could be. And unless they have got an estimate of the date, they will not do it, because they know perfectly well if they break that thing into 10 samples and take 10 radiometric dating, you'll get anything from 0 to 100 million years. So they want to choose the one which is closest to what it should be. So the date you get from a radiometric dating lab, either you have to tell them what the date is that you expect, or else you've got to tell them where it came from so they can look on the map and see what the date is supposed to be. Yes?
One thing that the what they're forgetting, the evolutionists, is that 4,800 years ago, there was a flood. And it was a major flood, not a local flood.
And they don't like the evidence for it either.
But the funny thing is, you find mussel shells up on Mount Everest. How do they wash up there? Things are so easily disproven to them, but they just don't want to listen, simply.
Well, yes, one thing that is a very easy proof of exactly that age is the record of the Earth's axis tilt. Now, there was an astronomer, Australian, he's called George Dodwell, and around about maybe 80, 90 years ago, he was studying the tilt of the Earth's axis. And he discovered that all over the world, there are records of axis tilt measurements going back right to the till the Egyptian foundations. And he examined all those observations, plotted them, and found that they all lay on a curve which went vertical about 4,800 years ago. And he put two and two together and said, hey, but that's when the flood was. Now, this curve, he analyzed it and found it to be a a logarithmic sine curve, which is the curve of recovery of a top after it's been struck. So he said, wait, this looks as if the Earth has been hit by a meteorite. And he worked out how big a body it would have to be to displace the Earth from zero axis tilt, because all the other planets, their satellites have got a zero axis tilt, or very close to zero. But the Earth has got a significant axis tilt. And he worked out that it would take an impacting body of 200 kilometers in diameter. Now, in the 1960s, Alvarez, a team of geologists, they found the remnant of a, well, they found a layer of nickel-rich material 1 centimeter thick, which appears to cover the whole Earth. It goes all around the Earth. Wherever you come to that formation and it's exposed, you find that nickel-rich layer. And they said, well, look, the only way this can happen is if a nickel iron meteorite struck the Earth, it vaporized, and that vaporized nickel came down all over the Earth. And they realized this was a disaster for geology, because geology relies on Lyell's uniformity principle. And Lyell's uniformity principle there is specifically there to deny the flood. And it says, no causes whatever have happened, as far as we can look back in history, apart from those forces now acting, and they have never acted with degrees of energy different from what they now exert. In other words, everything goes back in history as far as you can see, and it's always been just like it is now, which specifically denies the flood. But now the fact that there was a huge meteorite in impact is going to destroy it as well. So a group of scientists from California Institute of Technology, they did calculations and said, look, if this meteorite was 10 kilometers in diameter, it would produce tidal waves 3 miles high. That's a bit more than 5 kilometers high. And they would encircle the entire Earth in 27 hours. And this amazed them, so they rechecked their calculations, got other people to do them too. And it turns out they all check, and they presented this at a conference and said, look, this meteorite impact would have caused these waves moving at these enormous speeds, engulfing the entire Earth in 27 hours. How could any land-dwelling creature survive? Well, nobody wanted to answer that question. It was pushed under the carpet. But 10 kilometers was the estimate they made for this meteorite, to keep it as small as possible. But since then, other evidence has turned up which makes them think it was bigger, and NASA eventually put out a new artist's impression. Their first artist's impression had been a 10 kilometer diameter impacting body, and then they put out a revised artist's impression, which was 200 kilometers in diameter, exactly what George Dalrymple had calculated. And the curve, you can go to libraries all over the world and get the data and plot it, and you will find it comes vertical about 4,800 years ago.
And where did it get to then?
Well, Dodwell presumed the Pacific, because if you look for a place on the Earth which looks as if it's been hit by a meteorite, it's the Pacific. All around it, everything's been pushed up as mountains. The ring of fire is there because the crust broke up and volcanoes have come up. It appears to be the Pacific Ocean. It's interesting that if you look at the opposite side of the Earth to the center of the Pacific Ocean, and it's pretty well in the area of Jerusalem. And if you look back over the history of the Bible, Jerusalem is such an important place in God's whole story. What if the ark was made there? Now, the significance for that would be, if the impact was this side and these tidal waves would shoot around the earth in all directions, and instead of hitting the ark and smashing it to pieces, they'd all arrive together and lift it up in a body. That's an interesting it's an interesting possibility.
I'm just a naive human being, but I believe in God. If God says he made the earth in 6 days and on the seventh day he rested, I might as well believe it, because I wasn't there. So he says so, and if you go back how long the people lived, comes the earth about 6,800 years old. And I might as well just believe it, because they haven't found any other life as far as yet. They can go to Mars and die there, they won't find any other life. If there would be, God would have said so. Simple as that.
Yes. Now, all this mess that science has got itself into, it would all have been avoided if they had taken the advice of what would now be considered the greatest scientist who ever lived. Now a scientist is judged on the number of papers he publishes. Well, the person who published the most papers was Leonhard Euler. He was an absolutely brilliant man, and for 50 years, a third of all the papers published in the world on mathematics, physics, and engineering mechanics were published by Euler, and they're all really solid, fundamental stuff. And he said, in our researches into the phenomena of the physical world, we are subject to weaknesses and inconsistencies so humiliating that a revelation was absolutely necessary to us, and we ought to avail ourselves of it with the most powerful veneration. In simple terms, in science, we make such blunders, we need the Bible to keep us on track. And if people had simply followed his advice, we wouldn't have this evolution, we wouldn't have the Big Bang, we wouldn't have these millions of years, we wouldn't have any of this nonsense. And science wouldn't be in the mess it's in today.
So I rather believe that I was created, that my grandfather came from a rock millions and millions of years ago, and the bionic soup and whatever else.
Yeah, but the second law of thermodynamics guarantees anyway that genes cannot last that long. There's been work done fairly recently which shows that genes are being damaged at such a rate, and fixation of mutations in genes is going on at such a rate that life cannot be more than a few thousand years old. Life is a short-term phenomenon. It only lasts as long as the second law of thermodynamics allows the reproduction to stay accurate enough to keep things alive. And about 10 years ago, it was discovered that human infertility is increasing at 1.5% per annum. Now, these tests were all done on male infertility because it's so much easier to measure than female infertility. But the female reproductive system is so much more complex. There's so much more that can go wrong that it's probably quicker in females. And increasing infertility at 1.5% per annum, life cannot go on much longer before it's all sterile. Now, there are creatures going extinct every year, many every year. If you look back in the past, the number of creatures, the number of different kinds of creatures there are is vastly more than there are now, many times more. And they're gradually dying out because once the genetic code gets corrupted too far, it cannot be repaired and things can't reproduce. Life is a short-time phenomenon. There are infertility conferences going on because there's so much concern about the infertility that's rising. And some people at these conferences say that already more than a third of the world's population is infertile. Now, once you're at, you know, when you start off and you get 1%, 1% of very little is still very little. 1% of a third, that every year, that is significant. We can look forward to the human population not being around for much more than a few hundred years. Now, what they've also been finding at the in these infertility conferences is they have been staving off the disaster because they've been able to use medical help to enable people who cannot conceive naturally anymore to conceive with medical help. But the problem is they find the children that are born that way have even more difficulty than their parents, and it's getting harder and harder to prolong the lifespan of the generation by medical means. Now, Jesus said, "When I return, will I find faith upon the earth?" Now, if he waits very much longer, he'll have to ask, "When I return, will I find life upon the earth?" So I'm convinced that Jesus can't be all that far away from getting ready to come.
The universities, the academic elite, and you can't push those doors open because it's like a Nazi or a totalitarian situation. So what do we do as Christians? What do we do for our young people? What do we do for the future of science? Because obviously it is a mix. It's not science. It's evolution. Evolution is not science.
True.
So what do we do?
What we need is Christians to take over science. Now, that may sound to you impossible, but I can give you two examples. I was at Lausanne University. It's a famous university, everybody calls it APFL, the Polytechnic University of Lausanne. It's a very famous university, very highly regarded for its research. And when I was last there, there was a project which had been going on for something like 10 years. It was a plasma physics project, very expensive advanced materials, equipment, and there were physicists from all over the world working there. And in something like 10 years, they hadn't produced one result. Not one paper could be written on what they'd found because they hadn't found anything. Then an American physicist, he asked me not to give his name because he said he still had opportunities to witness to his colleagues. That's actually maybe long enough ago for him to have retired, but just in case not, I won't tell you his name. But he came there, and within 6 months he had got enough material to publish several important papers. And his colleagues were astounded, and they had a meeting and they said, look, how is this possible? We've been working on with this equipment for 10 years, we've got nothing. You come for 6 months and you've got all this. He says, how is that possible? He said, well, you see, what you get out of the equipment depends on the questions you put to it. Now, you all believe that the universe began in a big bang billions of years ago and everything develops by chance over all these billions of years. And the questions you put to the apparatus fit in with that worldview. Is that I believe that God created this universe just a few thousand years ago, and I put questions to the apparatus which fit that worldview, and this is what I get. Now, the other example that I could give, it's nothing like a spectacular, but I am working in a field, it's dealing with soils, particularly clays, and the story is, these form over millions of years, and forming over millions of years, you can come to certain conclusions about what you'll, how they will perform and what you'll find there. So I don't approach it to presuming it's millions of years. And for the last 2 years, I've won the most prestigious geotechnical award in the country, the Jennings Award for outstanding research. And the reason I could do that is because I am looking at things that nobody else would think of looking at, because this could not be important with something that takes millions of years to produce. Now, I don't believe it takes millions of years. I think that clays form and they change very quickly. And so the work that I'm doing works on that assumption and looks at clays from that point of view, and it's something nobody has found before. I I'm getting these awards for original research, but if anybody had approached this with the attitude, creation's just a short, you know, it's just a short time ago, they would have reached the same conclusions that I've reached. And what science needs is Christians to get it back on track and start looking in the right direction. Because the evolutionists aren't going to look in the right direction. And science is in an absolute mess.
The problem is what they call science is theory, and science is not theory. Science is what you can prove.
Well, science is a Christian discipline which was proposed by Roger Bacon, and his reason for proposing it was the creation carries the stamp of the creator. Our reason carries the stamp of our own folly. And we will have it that nature behaves in the way we think it should behave. But it doesn't. It behaves the way the Creator made it. And the only way to see how things really work is we must observe the creation, take careful measurements, look for patterns in those measurements, and they will tell us how the creation works, not our pathetic reasoning. And that is the scientific method. You make observations, you take measurements, you look for patterns in them, and then you come up with hypotheses to explain why this might be like this. And then you have to do experiments, new experiments which have not been done before, which will give a result and show whether that hypothesis can be true or not. And if you do many tests and eventually you find that there's not one contradiction, then you can be pretty confident you've got a law of nature. But if at any time an experiment shows that that hypothesis is wrong, you must abandon it. And that is science. That's what Newton and Euler and Faraday and the great Christian scientists did. And they made such astounding progress that the atheists said, hey, what they're doing works. We can do that too. Then in about 1840, a group of these atheist scientists decided they were going to make science a really respected discipline. Now, up to that time, anybody could do science. Anybody could look into God's creation, examine it, and see what they could find from it. Everybody was welcome to do so. Most scientists were amateurs. But then this group in America started to insist that the scientist is somebody who's qualified in science. He has to have science qualifications recognized. Recognized by, well, a scientific establishment. And then to be science, it has to be published in a journal of science. And they started publishing the journals of science. And if you are going to be considered a scientist, you must have the degrees that we prescribe. You must publish in the journals that we prescribe. And if it's not published in our journals, it's not science. And if it is published in our journal, it is science. And then we go to the universities and we say, if your staff publish their results in our established journals, then we will pay you a fee. And so the universities, oh yes, well, we need that money. And now the universities publish a list of the journals that you're allowed to publish in, because they're the ones that will pay the university. So if you don't publish in those journals, the university's not happy because they don't get the fee. You get no recognition as a scientist, because if you publish in anywhere else, it's not counted as science. And to publish there, you have to stick within what the scientific establishment wants, and they dictate no criticism of evolution, no criticism of Einstein, no criticism of millions and billions of years. So, if you do not publish there, you're not a scientist. So, what do you do? Well, you have to do such work that it's genuine science. And there are journals that are publishing genuine science. There's a fairly well-known journal that long ago realized that Einstein's relativity is totally wrong. Now, everybody realized you're not allowed to publish in the establishment journals, so they started a journal called Galilean Electrodynamics, very well known. If you publish there, your university won't get any money, but there is a readership and they are making progress. There are other journals too. And if it gets to the stage where people realize the only real, genuine science that's worth looking at is in Christian journals, then they'll look at Christian journals.